Before we begin this episode of Gone Cold, we'd like to ask y'all a favor. Our good friend Arlene's uncle and best friend, Leon Lorales, was senselessly murdered on May 10, 1996, just outside of Brownwood, Texas. If you'd like to hear more about that case, you can listen to our episodes on it by going back to May 2021. Several of our other podcast pals have covered Leon's case too, so go check out those on The Fall Line, Murder in My Family, and Texas Wine and Crime. Arlene has been the lone force fighting for justice for Leon, but there's a major way you can help. If you're able, please consider donating to the GoFundMe campaign to help Arlene commission a memorial for her uncle, and most importantly, hire a private investigator to find out what happened to Leon. His killer or killers need to be brought to justice. We'll provide a link in this episode's show notes to Leon's GoFundMe. Again, if you can, please donate. Thanks, y'all. Also, I had written in the show notes and social media posts for last week's episode on Rachel Cook's disappearance that it was part 2 of 3. Well, I spoke too soon. We're going to have to do 4, just a heads up. If you're listening to this without listening to parts 1 and 2, you'll likely want to go back and do that before proceeding. It's going to make a lot more sense if you do. Anyway, now on to the episode.
The Gone Cold podcast may contain violent or graphic subject matter. Listener discretion is advised.
After Robert Cook had searched for his daughter Rachel for a couple years, turning over absolutely no sign of her, he wrote in his journal that he knew someone had taken her. Robert knew, he said, that Rachel was probably not alive. But still, he countered his darkest thoughts with slivers of hope, entertaining the notion that she might have fallen, hit her head, and was somewhere out there suffering from amnesia. It wasn't likely, he knew, but still, it was a thread to grasp onto. Since Rachel disappeared on January 10, 2002, presumably either while out on her morning run or just after she got back to her family's property as she finished that run, her mother Janet was admitted to a psychiatric hospital twice. She, too, knew in her heart that the worst had befallen her oldest daughter. The searches, waiting for DNA results any time a body was found in Texas, the uncertainty, the PTSD, and the fact that Robert Cook was growing more consumed with Rachel's disappearance by the day took a toll on he and Janet, and they divorced. Joanne struggled to maintain close relationships as she navigated her way through high school and into university without her big sister. When a new acquaintance asks the sibling of a missing person if they have any brothers or sisters, what are they supposed to say? It was easier for Joanne to just avoid making friends altogether. Rachel was her best friend, the person she looked up to most in the world. So when she'd wake up after dreaming that her sister had never disappeared or had come back unharmed, Joanne felt as if she was forced to relive the pain and feeling of loss, as if it had just happened again. She went through that over and over, countless times, and likely still does. Rachel's grandparents became disillusioned with the world after she vanished. Her grandmother, in fact, lost her faith. Although many searches that were record-breaking in scope were performed, and other investigative avenues were traveled in the 4 years after the puzzling disappearance of Rachel Cook, the leads produced never got anyone any closer to finding out what happened to her. But in 2006, something sudden and unexpected happened. Something that rocked Robert, Janet, and Joanne Cook. Like going from 0 miles per hour to 1,000 in an instant. After years of nothing came a big something. A confession to Rachel Cook's murder. Mm-hmm. prison often produces the opposite effect than the intended one, rehabilitation. This problem is huge and too complicated to get into detail here, but prison conditions, abuse at the hands of guards and other inmates, and the lack of resources available to begin planning a new life on the outside all contribute. Judging by comments made by his father, however, conditions and rehabilitation programs could have been ideal, perfect, and his son, Michael Keith Moore, would still have remained a monster after serving his time. A master manipulator and liar, his father said, Moore has always completely lacked the emotion of remorse. Born on October 5, 1975, in Travis County, Texas, Michael Keith Moore's first brush with the law occurred when he was only 13. His juvenile record went on to consist of at least three burglary charges. Those charges, along with leading police on a high-speed chase through Waller County and calling in a bomb threat to Leander High School, had Moore going back and forth from Texas to Kansas, where his father lived. But it was no use, no punishment his parents or the justice system laid down kept the teenager out of trouble. And in fact, the nature of Moore's crimes grew progressively worse. In December of 1992, when he was 17 years old and living in Georgetown, Texas, Michael Keith Moore went around town and broke vehicle and home windows using a BB gun over the period of 2 weeks. In all, there was a total of 62 incidents, and the damage totaled almost $6,000. He was arrested, convicted of criminal mischief, and sentenced to 60 days in jail for the destruction, to be served on weekends, along with 10 years probation. When teenage Moore didn't show to serve his first weekend in the Williamson County Clink, authorities discovered he'd been locked up in Travis County on domestic abuse charges. Moore had punched his girlfriend, who was 20 years older than him, in the face and stomach and put a knife to her throat, a violent warning of what Moore would later become. That was in April of 1993, and the assault, which was also a major probation violation, landed him in prison for the next 4 years. Less than a year after he got out, in September of 1998, Moore was pulled over for speeding in Travis County, and the officer discovered a knife in his vehicle with an 8.5-inch blade. That was a parole violation, and though he got out on bail, he was later sent back to prison for that violation, where he spent 2 years. After he got out again, Moore was right back at it. On November 2, 2001, Georgetown 911 dispatch received a call from a cell phone belonging to Michael Keith Moore. The caller sounded like a woman and whispered to the 911 operator that she was being raped, and then the call abruptly ended. Moore outright denied the call was ever made at all, but when presented with the easily obtained evidence that it was indeed made, Moore told the police he called 911 because he was choking. As will become apparent later, toying with police is one of Moore's favorite pastimes. On November 4, 2001, Moore tried to buy items at a Cedar Park, Texas Walmart with a stolen credit card. He got 14 months for that, but that sentence wasn't handed down until June 2002. Late the following month, December 2001, Michael Keith Moore and an accomplice made off with $2,000 after robbing an insurance company in Round Rock, Texas with a semi-automatic pistol, though that crime went unsolved for a couple years, as he bragged about getting away with it to relatives and friends. Like a hog in cool mud on a hot Texas day, Moore wallowed in the media coverage of the armed robbery. Descriptions in the news had the perpetrator much older than him, and Moore reveled in it. In January of 2002, the month Rachel Cook vanished while on a morning run, Michael Keith Moore committed a series of crimes, or was at least arrested and charged for crimes he'd committed in the past. Those January 2002 charges include third-degree felony criminal mischief, aggravated robbery, and, according to his record, first-degree aggravated kidnapping, the details of which are elusive. On January 18, 2002, Moore was arrested for filing a false report, the result of the call to 911 from his cell phone the previous November. Though that charge was dropped, police had apparently obtained a warrant to search Moore's home while he was in jail, and when they executed that warrant, they found stolen tools, stolen stereo equipment, and a semi-automatic pistol, which, of course, is a pretty major parole violation. Moore was sent back to prison, where he stayed until June 2003. These crimes took place in Georgetown, Texas, and in fact, Moore was living in that city's northeast at the time, about 13 miles east of the home of Rachel Cook. On November 24, 2003, 27-year-old Michael Keith Moore walked into the Georgetown, Texas police station. He'd been summoned there to discuss accusations of sexual assault. 4 days earlier, at an area party, a 20-year-old woman's clothes were cut off of her as she slept, and she was subsequently raped. Moore would be questioned one more time about raping this woman. Although he was never charged, his choice to waltz into Georgetown Police Headquarters that September day was pretty ballsy, considering the day before he had violently murdered a woman. In Round Rock, Texas, on Tuesday, September 23, 2003, Robert Moore traveled home from work to eat lunch with his wife, Christina, and their 14-month-old daughter, Gracie. Christina was also nearly 4 months pregnant. The last name here is not a coincidence, and we'll get to that, but these folks are not related to Michael Keith Moore. When Robert entered his home, he realized quickly that this day was not like others. Immediately upon walking in, Robert noticed blood on the family's small white terrier, who had tracked the substance throughout the living room. He called out for Christina as he headed to the master bedroom. There, in the closet, Robert Moore discovered his wife's body. The lower portion of the closet walls were splattered and stained in blood, as was a nearby dresser, and his wife's lower legs sat in a large pool of her blood as she knelt there, lifeless. The family's other dog, a black miniature schnauzer, was standing guard beside her. Christina's throat had been slit about an inch deep, one major artery severed completely in two. And the woman not only bled out where she'd been found by her husband, she'd also suffocated from choking on her own blood. Blood coated the bench inside the closet, suggesting Christina had slumped over it to support herself as she kneeled, bleeding and dying. Handcuffs dangled from Christina's right forearm. Robert frantically called police before going into shock. When officers arrived to surveil the scene, the Moore's black schnauzer continued to stand watch over Christina, growling and yipping at the first responders. 14-month-old Gracie, luckily, was found in her crib unharmed. As detectives inspected the scene, they found three partial shoe prints left by blood in the home's bathroom. No footprints were found anywhere else in the house. There were no signs of forced entry, no signs that Christina had been raped, but her father told the police that her rings and purse were missing. The motive seemed clear. Evidence that might help identify the killer, however, was elusive, and the case baffled police and went unsolved for a while. During this time, Robert Moore's name continually circled the rumor mill as the person responsible, even as his family put up a $50,000 reward for information leading to the perpetrator. These rumors weren't for nothing. The cops, too, suspected the husband for many reasons, many standard reasons. Such crimes are more often than not committed by someone close to the victim, and there was no evidence of forced entry into the Moore home. Round Rock police began interviewing friends, relatives, and co-workers of the widower. They pored through his financial records and put a GPS tracking device on his vehicle, but nothing abnormal was found. Even folks at his early morning Bible study and co-workers had vouched for his whereabouts that entire morning up until lunch. Absolutely nothing was pointing in a direction that screamed Robert Moore was responsible for his wife's horrific slaying. Finally, the detective in charge of the murder of 35-year-old Christina Moore decided to quit wasting the investigation's time going after the husband. Robert Moore gave every indication during interrogation that he was in heavy mourning and incredibly invested in the apprehension of his wife's killer. A different man, surnamed Moore, however, seemed to be begging for the cops' suspicion. Michael Keith Moore is cocky and arrogant. He fancies himself smarter than whoever he's around at any given time, even though he's been tested and is said to be of average intelligence. Perhaps whoever tested Moore was feeling especially nice or grading on a curve the day they did. On September 27, 2003, 4 days after Christina Moore was viciously murdered in her home, Michael Keith Moore made an anonymous phone call to the Round Rock police. In a payphone coin slot, he told detectives he had found checks in the slain woman's name. It seemed that Michael Keith Moore had kicked up a notch his predilection for fucking with the cops. But the way he did it ended up as a major clue against him in the case. Still, the murder of Christina Moore remained unsolved for the time being. Moore spent the month of November in jail, arrested on a parole violation for supplying minors with alcohol at the same party he was accused of raping a 20-year-old woman. Michael Keith Moore had married, divorced, and remarried a woman, Becky, who was 20 years his senior. She had at least 2 children from a previous relationship and a son with Moore. In late February of 2004, Moore's stepdaughter-in-law paid a visit to Williamson County, Texas deputies. On Tuesday, February 24, 2004, she told police she had awoken to Moore in her bed, rubbing her leg. Although we were not able to find clear and sufficient details to elaborate much more than that on this strange and unsettling crime, it is known that Moore broke into the home in order to do it. Moore knew, his stepdaughter-in-law told police, that she was going to be home alone that particular night. During her talk with deputies, who were co-investigating the murder of Christina Moore the previous September, she mentioned that Michael Keith Moore had once spoke of having some of the slain woman's checks in his possession. Later, but not by much, detectives contacted her and played the recording of the anonymous caller who claimed to have found Christina Moore's checks in a payphone coin slot. The anonymous voice, his stepdaughter-in-law told the cops, was Michael Keith Moore. When he was arrested 2 days later, the extent of the man's depravity became better known, though likely not entirely known. At the hearing to determine if sufficient evidence existed to prove a parole violation, Moore's parole officer suggested to the court that he be given a sex offender evaluation. After all, a prior and recent revocation hearing involved the rape of a passed-out 20-year-old woman. But that wasn't it. While in prison a few years before, Moore had written letters to his then-teenage stepdaughter that were called sexually charged. Moore also stole his teenage stepdaughter's underwear several times, secretly videoed her, and once tried to cut off her shorts as she slept. The same thing he did to the 20-year-old woman he was never held accountable for raping. During a majority of the years 2004 and 2005, Michael Keith Moore was locked up in the Williamson County Jail where he was known to expose himself and masturbate in front of female inmates. While Moore remained in jail for breaking and entering and the assault on his stepdaughter-in-law, police in Round Rock sought evidence to prove that he handcuffed and slit Christina Moore's throat. In July 2004, investigators traveled northwest to Florence, where a trailer owned by Moore sat. Christina Moore had worn a distinct pair of earrings at her wedding, and those earrings disappeared the day she was killed. One reappeared at Moore's Florence home on the hood of a riding lawnmower parked in his yard. When confronted with the discovery, Moore kept tight-lipped with detectives, but spilled his guts in a Williamson County jail cell. It was later at trial that cellmates of Moore testified. He broke into Christina's home, the cellmates recalled Moore saying, and after handcuffing the woman to a chair near the closet, he placed Gracie, the 14-month-old baby, into her crib. Moore proceeded to ransack the room, looking for valuables to steal. When it was all said and done, he'd found and taken a jewelry box, credit cards, checks, and wedding rings. After Christina refused to sign any of the checks or give the robber her PIN number, he placed a knife to her neck to try and scare her. 35-year-old Christina knelt sobbing and begged for her life and the life of her baby to be spared, Moore said, according to his cellmates. When she still refused, Michael Keith Moore deeply sliced her throat. Moore chose Christina and Robert Moore's home because he figured it would be easier to cash stolen checks and use stolen credit cards if those things bore his last name. Since Michael Keith Moore wasn't going anywhere anytime soon and sat safe and sound in a Williamson County jail cell, Round Rock police detectives and the Williamson County District Attorney's Office investigator took their time developing a case. They wanted to secure the conviction and released little to no details of their investigation to the press, even when they indicted Moore for Christina's slaying in November of 2004. By the time trial came in February of 2006, significant circumstantial evidence and witnesses had been collected. The bloody shoe prints matched boots Moore owned. The accused's own wife testified to seeing checks belonging to Christina Moore in his truck, and there was the earring found on Moore's property that matched one belonging to the slain woman. During testimony, Christina's husband, Robert, talked about witnessing a man whose face he didn't get a look at, lumbering toward a small red pickup on his street as he left for work. Michael Keith Moore owned a red Ford Ranger at this time. The slain woman's mother was visiting the couple from California, but left that very morning at about 6:25 a.m. to head to the airport. Though she didn't speak of seeing a red truck, she did pass a jogger who was on her way into the cul-de-sac where her daughter and son-in-law lived. That jogger testified that as she circled through the court, she heard a blood-curdling scream. Although Moore's DNA was nowhere to be found at the scene of Christina's brutal and merciless slaying, the defense rested without calling witnesses. After closing arguments, the jury convicted Michael Keith Moore of felony murder, rejecting the charge of capital murder, which would have likely brought with it a death sentence. He was also found guilty of aggravated robbery and aggravated kidnapping. The guilty verdict came on a Friday, so sentencing had to wait till after the weekend. On Monday, February 13th, 2006, the court was shocked when a plea deal was announced. For acknowledging his guilt in the September 2003 murder of Christina Moore and all the charges that came with it, along with pleading guilty to a crime he'd long been suspected of, the robbery of a Round Rock insurance company in December of 2001, the prosecution offered to make it easy on the man. Pleading guilty to all these crimes, the deal was that Moore served the sentences for them concurrently, 4 life sentences, and 1 10-year sentence. Also, by accepting this plea, Michael Keith Moore waived his rights to an appeal. Though it may seem like there was nothing in it for Moore, there certainly was. The deal set his parole eligibility at 30 years instead of 60. Also, as a result, and the day following the plea deal's finalization, Moore led investigators from Round Rock to his Florence home. Once they arrived, police dug where Moore directed them to, beneath a cactus, until they found what the killer had hidden there, Christina Moore's wedding rings. It's unclear if Robert Cook kept up with Michael Keith Moore and the murder of Christina Moore just 20 miles south of where his daughter, 19-year-old Rachel Cook, disappeared more than 4 years before the conviction. If I had to guess, knowing how his daughter's case had consumed him, I'd say he was perfectly aware of the case and the trial, and every other murderer and missing person in a large proximity to his Williamson County home. Just months after Moore was sent to a Gatesville, Texas prison, no matter the scope of Robert Cook's knowledge of him, he would become all too familiar with the convicted killer. By 2006, the Williamson County Sheriff's Office, the Texas Rangers, nonprofit organizations, private investigators, and especially Robert Cook had spent tens of thousands of hours searching for and investigating the case of missing 19-year-old Rachel Louise Cook. But no one had ever found a thing to suggest the young woman had met with foul play, nothing to suggest she had been involved in a terrible accident, and most certainly nothing to suggest she ran off somewhere on her own. Literally thousands of leads were followed in efforts to locate Rachel, but the case never saw anything that could be considered a major break. Then came Michael Keith Moore. In August 2006, 6 months after his conviction for the murder of Christina Moore in Round Rock, Texas, Michael Moore sent word that he had a confession to make. Williamson County Sheriff's Office investigators were more than willing to travel to the Texas Department of Corrections Alfred Hughes unit in Gatesville to listen. When they arrived, Moore sat and explained to the detectives what he'd done back on January 10, 2002. As police videoed him, Michael Keith Moore told them that on that day, he'd been driving around Georgetown and the surrounding areas looking for something to steal. As he cruised the quiet streets of the North Lake subdivision just west of town, he saw a young woman jogging along the road. He stopped his pickup truck, Moore told the cops, got out, approached the woman, and struck her in the head with a hammer. Moore dragged her to his truck, drove to another location, raped and suffocated Rachel Cook, the convicted killer continued, before wrapping her in a tarp, placing her in the bed of his truck, driving 187 miles to Matagorda Bay, and dumping her body, weighed down by rocks sealed in the tarp, in the Gulf of Mexico. The thought of Moore driving more than 3 hours away with a body in the back of his pickup seemed a little dumb, but investigators certainly weren't listening to the confession of the sharpest tool in the shed. It seemed unlikely, anyway, that Moore would implicate himself in the murder of Rachel Cook if he hadn't actually done it. The story was definitely plausible and made sense, or made enough sense. Michael Keith Moore was living about 13 miles east of the Cook's home at the time, is reported to have driven a pickup, and a pickup was seen driving through the North Lake subdivision the day Rachel vanished. The fact that he'd been convicted of a senseless and barbaric murder certainly helped his believability in this confession. So, Williamson County Sheriff's Office investigators not only accepted Moore's confession, they also began looking into his movements and whereabouts deeper for corroborating facts and details, as they prepared to bring him before a judge. Authorities in Williamson County discovered that the Lampasas police were looking at Moore for an attempted kidnapping that took place 21 days before Rachel Cook disappeared. At about 10 p.m. on December 20, 2001, a Lampasas woman arrived at her home from work. A truck immediately pulled up behind her vehicle, and the man driving got out, approached the young woman, and began a conversation. Out of nowhere, the man grabbed her. They struggled, and luckily the woman got loose and fled into her home. The man returned to his truck and sped off. Michael Keith Moore had come to the attention of Lampasas police investigator Jody Cummings when he was tried and convicted of Christina Moore's murder. And based on the description of the would-be abductor, Cummings said, Moore is a suspect in his case. It was well established at this point that Moore had long ago crossed the line from criminally mischievous petty thief to dangerous and depraved sexual predator. So investigators in Williamson County were sure they had the guy responsible for Rachel Cook's disappearance. But there were problems. Michael Keith Moore showed detectives where he supposedly dumped Rachel's weighed-down body into the Matagorda Bay, but after several intensive and careful searches, no sign of her could be found. Also, not a speck of Rachel's blood was discovered on her running route. Nothing to suggest she'd met with foul play. But surely, if Moore had bludgeoned her in the head with a hammer to incapacitate her, some blood would have been found. Moore didn't match any of the composite sketches of strange men seen in the Northlake subdivision the day Rachel went missing. Reports, mostly later television shows, depicted in dramatizations Moore driving a white pickup truck like the one witnesses saw near the Cook home that day. However, official reports never specify such a thing, and almost 2 years later, Moore was driving a red Ford Ranger. We can find no evidence that anyone placed Moore in a truck matching the description of the one seen near the Cook home the day Rachel disappeared, a white truck. And out of the 21 months between Rachel's disappearance and the murder of Christina Moore, Michael Keith Moore was in jail 18 months. But regardless, none of these issues made Moore's confession an impossibility, and he agreed to plead guilty to killing Rachel Cook as long as the sentence the prosecutor wanted, a life sentence, could be served concurrently, leaving his parole eligibility at 30 years, a product of his previous plea. But also in accordance with the deal, Moore was to lead investigators to where he buried the jewelry Rachel Cook was wearing, as well as other personal effects. The Cook family, her parents Robert and Janet and sister Joanne, had lived with torturous uncertainty for over 4 years. They thought knowing what happened to Rachel would bring them at least some peace. But they were wrong. The Cooks were devastated when they learned of Moore's confession, when they found out Rachel was truly dead after having been bludgeoned with a hammer, raped, and suffocated. Finally, months after the confession of Michael Keith Moore for the murder of Rachel Cook, it was time for the deal to become official before a judge. On November 9, 2006, to a packed courtroom that included Rachel's immediate family and plenty of extended family, Moore had to face her parents and sister. It was finally over, the Cooks thought. When the judge asked Michael Keith Moore how he pleaded, however, the man replied, not guilty, to the shock of the entire courtroom. Thinking perhaps the convicted killer had misspoken or been misheard, the judge asked again, and Moore's answer was the same. As the spectators gasped and exchanged whispers, Michael Moore's attorney called for a recess. He told his client that he'd already agreed to the deal, but Moore didn't give a shit. He would not honor it, he told counsel. The prosecutor, of course, was livid. He threatened the bad faith actor with a trial where he would push very hard toward the death penalty. But Moore's glazed-over, soulless eyes stared right through him, as if he was apathetically responding to the prosecutor's threats louder than words could ever be spoken or even screamed. Janet, Robert, and Joanne Cook were crushed again. They'd gone through the anguish of uncertainty for years, the devastation that came with Moore's confession to what he'd done to Rachel, and now the realization that the convicted killer might have made up the entire thing. And that's exactly what Michael Keith Moore claims he did. It was the preferential treatment he was after. A little vacation from his prison cell in Gatesville that included a trip to the coast to show investigators where he dumped Rachel's body. He ate cheeseburgers and other fast food fare during the trip and during questioning and plea deal sessions. While he was in prison, the cooperation he showed during the entire debacle allowed more special treatment in the form of extra visits from his wife. The sheriff at the time, James Wilson, insisted that Moore knew things only Rachel Cook's killer could have known. But that statement means nothing, since no one has ever found any physical evidence that Rachel or the perpetrator left behind. The details of Moore's story could have been picked up from reading the newspaper easily. The Williamson County District Attorney had absolutely no physical evidence, or even circumstantial evidence, against Michael Keith Moore, and whether his confession would ultimately be allowed into trial was on incredibly shaky ground. So a case against Moore has never again been pursued. Greg West, Rachel Cook's boyfriend at the time of her disappearance, was also devastated by Moore's games. To look at him was to look at pure evil, Greg said. And to drag the Cooks and all who loved Rachel through the fiasco was sick and psychotic, he added. Rachel's sister Joanne seemed almost speechless and told reporters the whole thing left her family with nothing but disbelief and anger. Michael Keith Moore's father knew his son was a remorseless criminal since he was a boy and that he was a rough-and-tumble tough guy. But he never thought him capable of murder until he sat and watched prosecutors present evidence against him at his trial for the slaying of Christina Moore. When the evidence was all presented, he knew they had nabbed the right guy, his son. The convicted killer's father wasn't so sure, however, that he was responsible for the disappearance of Rachel Cook. If he did something to her, his son deserves the death penalty, he said. But the confession was out of character for the remorseless man. There would have to be something bigger in it for him. Moore's father hoped the ordeal would lead the Cooks closer to the truth.
It's another one of his crimes, the convicted killer's father said, playing with those people's emotions.
We originally planned to tell Rachel Cook's story in 3 episodes. But we need another to tell the story of a suspect seldom mentioned, and another that has never been spoken about anywhere else, as far as we know. That's next time on Gone Cold. If you have any information about the disappearance of Rachel Louise Cook, please contact the Williamson County Sheriff's Office at 512-948-2911. Or their cold case tip line at 512-943-5204. The Austin American Statesman, the Austin Daily Texan, KXAN.com, KVUE.com, Fox7Austin.com, and the Journal of Robert Cook were used as sources for this episode. You can support the show at patreon.com/GoneColdPodcast. There, you can get the show ad-free and enjoy Patreon-exclusive episodes that tell stories of mostly solved Texas crimes and the bad actors who perpetrated them. I get those out as much as I can, which is not as often as I would like. We also donate some proceeds to DNASolves.com and the Fort Worth Cold Case Support Group. Speaking of those two great causes, you can help solve cold cases and help identify Jane and John Doe's by supporting one of the many crowdfunding efforts at DNASolves.com, and you can upload your DNA data to the database there. It's only used for law enforcement investigations. DNA Solves is Authorm Incorporated, the folks who solved the Carla Walker case alongside the Fort Worth Police Department. If you want to help the Fort Worth Police solve a cold case, you can donate directly to them at fwpdcoldcasesupport.org. We'll provide a link to both DNA Solves and the Fort Worth Police Cold Case Support Group in the episode's show notes. Another way you can support Gone Cold is by leaving us a 5-star rating and written review on iTunes or wherever else you listen. Those reviews help Gone Cold's visibility, which helps new listeners find us, which increases the potential for someone with information hearing the show and reporting what they know to authorities. We appreciate more than words can express any support you give Gone Cold, DNASolves.com, the Fort Worth Police Cold Case Support Group, or any other folks whose cause is to provide long overdue justice to victims or the families of victims. So, thank you in advance. Thanks for listening, y'all.